And welcome back to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Where can you put a solar panel? You could put some on your roof and possibly get enough electricity to power your own home, but where can solar power be developed on a massive scale? Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says, why not our public lands? Now the federal government is in the process of finalizing what it's calling solar energy zones with the goal of making solar development quicker while still incorporating conservation and wildlife management. Does this have the potential to bring solar energy to the masses in this country? Joining me now in the studio to discuss it is Sarah Baldwin. She's Senior Policy and Regulatory Associate at Utah Clean Energy. And Sarah, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Well, Sarah, how are these solar energy zones supposed to make the development of solar projects easier, from your understanding?
The idea of the solar energy zones, as proposed by the BLM with quite a lot of public input to date, is to really guide large-scale, utility-scale solar projects to areas within our public lands that are minimized in terms of their impact on wildlife, on culturally sensitive resources, on recreational areas, so that we can help move those projects as quickly as possible and save money and time for both the federal government as they're processing applications and also for the industry.
So how do you think the Interior Department came up with these areas that it's proposing? There's been a public process. What kind of factors might have been taken into account as they looked at this?
From what I'm familiar with, and they would have the down and dirty on all of the maps and science that went into these zones, but they did base the zone selection on the best available science, using all of the information from GIS surveys and wildlife surveys and wilderness surveys to ensure that the zones selected are the sort of the lowest hanging fruit for development. So they also looked at land use and military land and other archaeological sites that would not be applicable or appropriate for development, and they remove those from the zones.
So how do you think this will speed the process up exactly? Are companies being offered any sort of incentive to develop here, or is it just the fact that there would be a process in place so that, you know, it would be streamlined so that everyone goes through the same process, or what exactly?
Well, there are incentives outside of this effort, and I think that this effort in and of itself is a driving force for development simply because it saves time and money, and it saves the developers and the folks on the other end processing the applications from having to really, at every step and at every project, go through the exact same process. This will help streamline and create more of a standardized process that others can follow in the future. So I think really what this does is lays a good foundation for the first large-scale projects to come online quickly. And then as we learn more and get more familiarity with these projects, we will see probably more zones opened up and more understanding of how to do these projects with the least impact possible.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. My guest is Sarah Baldwin, Senior Policy and Regulatory Associate at Utah Clean Energy, and we're discussing the Bureau of Land Management's proposed solar energy zones on public lands in six western states. And Sarah, so I understand in the latest map, there's more than 200,000 acres that have been proposed. What do we see here in Utah that has the most potential and that the Interior Department has included, at least in the latest draft, for a solar energy zone?
So Utah zones are about 6,000 acres per zone, and so there are three primary zones making up about 17,700 acres approximately. Interestingly enough, most of them are located in the central west portion of the state. So those familiar with the Wawa Valley and the Milford Flats and the Escalante Valley, those are the three primary zones that have been proposed. Now, these are not the final zones, from my understanding. There will still be some additional iteration and feedback on their latest supplement, but those are the three primary zones. Now, those zones are sort of the priority. There may be other zones outside of those zones that might be applicable, but those have been identified as the first and foremost low-hanging fruit. They would potentially have the opportunity to develop anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 megawatts of solar within those zones. And depending on the technology used, say if you do solar PV, that could generate enough electricity equivalent to power about 190,000 Utah homes.
And Sarah, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we've seen solar projects here in Utah. We've got solar panels on the roof of the Leonardo and the Salt Palace. But in the big scheme of things, these only provide a small portion of the electricity, and not even all the electricity that the Salt Palace uses. It's only a fraction, like a quarter or a half, maybe. What are the biggest obstacles we've seen to large-scale solar development in this country? And how do you perhaps think these solar energy zones might begin to overcome that?
Well, I think one of the biggest obstacles is we haven't gone there yet. It really is a new frontier for us. We're very familiar with large-scale natural gas plants, large-scale coal plants, large-scale nuclear plants, but and really, as of late, large-scale wind power plants are also very common. The large-scale solar has not really taken hold, and part of that is economics. The economics have not been as favorable for solar as for the other resources. However, we are seeing drastic price declines, and even within the last year, we've seen about a 50% decline and projected continuous declines for the next couple of years for solar PV technology, which can be applicable for utility-scale applications. So there are the economic issues, and then there's also we've seen, you know, when Salazar was appointed to office in 2009, there were hundreds of solar, large-scale solar projects in the permitting process in the BLM and really just languishing in that office. And since his appointment and since priority has been given to solar, they've actually already permitted 13 projects. So it's a matter of kind of shifting focus a little bit as a country and as a federal government as they're trying to, prioritize clean energy development.
Sarah, one point that we should discuss is that here in Utah, we don't have a renewable energy mandate in state law. We do have one on the books, but it's not really a mandate because there aren't any penalties. So, for example, we don't have something that says 25% of our electricity must come from renewable resources by the year 2025, like California does have on their books. Do you think that this means that without this law, any solar projects we could see on public lands here in Utah would just send their power to California and Utahns really wouldn't benefit?
Well, that is a good question. We have what's considered to be a goal, and so we do have a 20% by 2025 goal for renewable energy. What's important to keep in mind is that energy is not a free market. So a lot of people and politicians especially like to say, well, we don't like mandates.
Right.
Well, in the scheme of things, if we want to change our energy portfolio in any significant way, we need policies to drive that because it is not going to happen on its own. It's not a free market. It doesn't work in that fashion. So it's really hard to apply free market principles. So under the current policy of a 20% goal, the key provision in that policy is that it says if cost-effective.
Right.
So we are seeing cost-effective resources being developed, being proposed across the state for wind, geothermal, solar. Now, the matter of whether or not those projects are going to be selected by the primary utility that serves the state, that's another question.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Sarah, we're speaking with Sarah Baldwin, Senior Policy and Regulatory Associate at Utah Clean Energy. To outside observers, it might seem like this process is all very slow. You mentioned that, and Secretary Salazar has sped up applications of solar projects, but others might wonder if there could be a faster process, why we're not seeing these projects, you know, just go right onto our public lands immediately and really push this country towards renewable energy in a much quicker fashion. What are your thoughts on that? Is it moving fast enough or should it be moving faster?
I think it's moving quite fast considering it's being led by a federal government, which is a very large bureaucracy in itself. What I do think initially was happening is a kind of a scattershot approach where projects were being permitted on a case-by-case basis, and that was impacting wildlife resource and wildlands and archaeological resources. And so I think that they needed to take a step back and do this really smart from the start. And you know, it would be great if all of our energy resources could be developed smart from the start and have a more strategic approach as we develop these new resources in new areas. So I think that it's doing the best that it can, and I think it's really setting a great foundation for solar development.
Sarah Baldwin with Utah Clean Energy has joined us to talk about these proposed solar energy zones from the Interior Department and Bureau of Land Management. Sarah, we appreciate your time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm Jeff Robinson. Politics Up Close is a production of KCBW News here in Salt Lake City on 88.3 and 105.3 FM. Listen to podcasts of the show on our website at kcbw.org. And listen to the program Friday mornings at 9 and Sunday mornings at 6 here on NPR Utah, KCPW. Thank you for joining us today on Politics Up Close.